Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 41, section 9, which is old single column, page 465. Okay, so we should be wrapping up this paper, this session. This section 9 is really the last section in this paper that, has a lot of immediate obvious scientific consequences. The final section is much more for the benefit of us as persons, as opposed to potential scientists or budding philosophers. They have a pattern in the Revelation where they take you on a journey and then they try to bring it home at the end. Try to help you feel your place in that context. So they definitely do it here again. You'll see they sort of take the opportunities that the next to the last section present, as an off ramp to bring it in, closer to home for us. And it ends up being, it's still in the astronomic context, but a little less intense on solar interior theory and this sort of thing, like we've been wrestling with here recently. Now, before we get started on that section 9, it occurred to me after we finished up the last section, often I'll get a reflection back on something I said, and it's like, whoops, wait a minute, did I misspeak? So I went and listened to the recording, and sure enough, remember when we were, it was in that next to the last paragraph of the previous section, section 8, we were talking about supernovas, and you remember how in the context of that supernova, historical supernova in the Andromeda Nebula that they were specifically referring to there, they were talking about what we now know or now refer to as electron neutrinos being put out in a huge flux during that collapse phase. And I mentioned that we got the chance to actually observe that very definitively for the first time with the supernova in 1987 in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And we not only had all kinds of modern telescopic observation techniques, but we had neutrino telescopes, quote unquote. These neutrino detectors, large neutrino detectors, and sure enough, we saw the signature of, even though it's very, very long ways away, outside of the Milky Way proper in the Large Magellanic Cloud. So you can imagine, even if it's a huge flux of neutrinos, you spread that over a sphere, and blow up the size of that sphere to the distance between there and here, and you're not going to get a lot of neutrinos, but we actually got a measurable signal with our initial technology of that. And I was just referring in passing to us measuring that a little bit in advance of us first seeing the light signal, which is what you would expect. The neutrinos come right out and are going to get here before the photons do. I mean, they're both traveling at the speed of light, but the neutrinos were emitted earlier. And I meant to say 2 to 3 hours before we saw the light, and I mistakenly said 2 to 3 days. I mean, if you think about it, that's not logical. It's, you know, the, remember they mentioned that that particular collapse with that Andromeda Nebula happened in just 40 minutes. Okay, so, you know, days is not the right time scale, right? You know, or at least that you'd expect it, that wouldn't be the correct time scale. And yeah, it is. It's we saw it, you know, in the 2 to 3 hours before the light signal range, see, which is more logical. Apologize for, I was kind of rushing right there at the end, and every once in a while, you know, your brain just says the wrong thing. but yeah, so just to clear that up, so that's not a confusion going forward with that recording. I should have said 2 to 3 hours. All right, so you see how they transition off of that. They were talking about that whole issue of in a late stage for some kinds of stars, things getting unstable and collapsing. You know, and so look what the next section is. You know, they're going to just pick up on that issue of sun stability in general. What about, you know, just the basic issue during the majority of the star's life, as opposed to, you know, some potential late stage instability like it might lead to a supernova explosion, you know, which is actually a implosion followed by a rebound and an explosion. You know, it isn't just sitting there and then explodes. It collapses and bounces off. Remember, it bounces off the ultimatons basically in their immutability, and you know, and you get this massive, recoil. That's the word I was looking for. Yes, this massive recoil off of that. You know, and it goes outward. Yep.
What does current science explain that? Where's that power? Is it, they just think of it as an explosion, or do they? They also recognize there's a collapse, don't they?
Right. You know, when you're doing it in the current theory, you are rebounding off of. Some foundational fact. It may be, for instance, you know, kind of more in the mode we were just talking about there. You know, what you're rebounding off may be what they call a neutron star, you know, a non-crushable object that it's bouncing off of. But it may actually be just, you know, they also imagine that there are going to be black holes that are formed at the center there. You know, and so you have a, you know, a phenomenon where it's reaching this, you know, extreme state, and there's just a flash of energy that then blows this, you know, stuff outward, you know, as just a critical state rather than so literally being, you know, something that's a, you know, basically a solid object that you're bouncing off of. But in the case of, you know, the actual theory the revelators are trying to put forward for us, you know, you also can have a solid object there, you know, not just the ultimatons. But ultimately, see, even if there's no solid object that can stop it, the ultimatons will. So in the actual picture, it's always something very literally that's, you know, that you're bouncing off of. Be it large or small.
Doesn't current science out of NASA say that our sun doesn't have very much longer? Don't they say
so? We're gonna get to that tonight. So okay. Yeah, that's obviously something that's gonna happen in sun stability under that subject. So yeah, just you'll see when we get to that. All right. So, but you'll notice, even though we are going to be talking about some technical things still in section 9, even in the next to the last section, they're starting to let up a little bit. It isn't quite as intense as, you know, in the previous one when we were trying to understand the what's currently called the CNO cycle, the carbon, nitrogen, oxygen cycle, and you know how that relates to the central temperature and all these complicated things that, you know, that we were trying to step our way through before. It's gonna be a little bit more straightforward to think about here. So let's see what they have for us.
Section 9, sun stability.
The larger suns maintain such a gravity control over their electrons that light escapes only with the aid of the powerful X-rays. These helper rays penetrate all space and are concerned in the maintenance of the basic ultimatonic associations of energy. The great energy losses in the early days of a sun subsequent to its attainment of maximum temperature, upwards of 35 million degrees, are not so much due to light escape as to ultimatonic leakage. These ultimaton energies escape out into space to engage in the adventure of electronic association and energy materialization as a veritable energy blast during adolescent solar times.
Okay, so there is a little bit of technical complexity there. Let's just pick through the various elements they threw into that paragraph. Okay, so it starts out again with a sentence encouraging you to make a recognition that I've stressed a few times already. See how they say the larger suns maintain such a gravity control over their electrons, and you're thinking, okay, that sounds not too odd, anything current. But then they say, over their electrons, that light escapes only with the aid of the powerful X-rays. Okay. So there you're seeing it again. Remember, like I've tried to point out, basically what they're doing, since we have a level of physical actualization that we call the electronic level, that level where you've started all the way down at the bottom with just single ultimatons, you've built all the way up until you have a collection of 100 ultimatons, and that's the foundation of that so-called electronic level. And since by that electronic level, you don't just mean the level of electrons, you mean the level of the fundamental particles that are built upon the foundation of a collection of 100 ultimatons. So they went ahead and when they want to stress that we're not just talking about some quantum of energy, but we're talking about a literal particle, i.e. one of those collections of 100 ultimatons with some measure, large or small, of electronic level energy wrapped around that foundational particle. We were thinking about it in that kind of simplistic way last time, imagining you've got this little sphere of 100 ultimatons and picturing this electronic energy that you're adding to that base, like picturing putting rubber bands around a core. So those bands, quote unquote, of electronic level energy are all built upon that foundation. One of those collections of 100 ultimatons with a little bit of electronic level energy added to that base is what we literally call an electron. But since it's the electronic level, you can use that word electron, one of the fundamental particles of the electronic level is another way you could kind of translate the word electron. So there you see they're doing it again. When they're talking about light escape, they're talking about what we technically would call a photon now, but with a little bit stronger emphasis than any current scientist tends to do on the fact that it's a particle. It's not just a packet of energy, or a particle-like fact. It's literally a particle. Just like the electron is a literal particle. It's a collection of 100 ultimatons with in the case of a photon and an electron, a very minimal addition upon that base. And see, so that's what they're doing there. So you're initially thinking they mean literally that charged particle called an electron, but then you're immediately saying, oh no, they don't mean that. They're talking about a particle of light. They're talking about a photon, literally, is a particle. Okay, so they're doing it there again and bringing in this X-ray idea that when they want it, like we've pointed out, when they want a contrast to the particle fact, you know, an individuality, a oneness, and suffix O-N, fact. They want to talk about just the waves and the force charge, that kind of energy that's not literally wrapped around a collection of 100 ultimatons. They've been using that term X-ray, and definitely, you know, in a specific sense, a lot of it is X-ray. But remember, we pointed out, think of it in a little more general terms. Maybe they mean really high energy ultraviolet and low energy gamma ray, and okay, but not particle. Okay, so they're just bringing that up again. And in this mode, even though the way they said it, see, is not really common today, they're starting off with, all right, so you can understand right now the idea of a star putting out waves of energy and electronic level particles of energy, like you know your sun has a solar wind and you've measured it now with quite a bit of detail with satellites, even, you know, measuring it in place, not waiting for one of these particles to hit the Earth and trying to understand its properties indirectly like that. We've sent satellites out there in orbit about the sun, and we've been measuring this, the electrons and the protons and the helium nuclei, the alpha particles that are boiling off of the sun. Okay, so they start with that. They start with something that we can appreciate, the electronic level stuff, and then just remind you of the specifics a little bit more so you don't think it quite so billiard ball model like we do now. And even then saying, talking about those X-rays, I mean, obviously, if a star gives off X-rays, they go off in space, and we certainly know that can energize. If there's a cloud, if there's a nebula nearby, that could energize that nebula. We certainly know that outgoing energy is impacting the environment beyond the star. So they're just invoking that basic idea that we can appreciate. But then they're reminding us that with the same idea, there's much more fundamental phenomena than just that electronic level energy output going from a star. In the middle of the paragraph, and they say the great energy losses in the early days of a sun, subsequent to its attainment of maximum temperature, upwards of 35 million degrees Fahrenheit, remember that is, are not so much due to light escape, in other words, particle escape, electronic level particle escape, as to ultimatonic leakage. Okay, now that obviously is something that's not even remotely imagined in current science. There is no sub-electronic structure to particles in current science. So think about what they're reminding. They're reminding us of what they told us about stellar energy generation back a couple of sections, when they pointed out that the processes that you currently understand, the most extreme processes that you're currently aware of, those ones that they called transmutation of elements, item number 2 in the list of most important sources of energy, that there's something more fundamental. Remember that 35 million degrees Fahrenheit was the star is collapsing, in the early stages, coalescing, and it's getting hotter and hotter in the center until finally it gets to what they call the electronic boiling point. The boiling point, quote-unquote, of those collections of 100 ultimatons, those fundamental particles of the electronic level. Not just the charged particle electron boiling, but all collections of 100 ultimatons unraveling, coming apart. Item number 1, the annihilation of atoms and eventually of electrons. You know, and the annihilation sense of literally taking it apart into its component automatons, completely unraveling it, so you have free automatons. See, so when they invoke that, it's attaining that maximum temperature. That's when you're going to be unraveling whatever material has gone in. It's going to be unraveled into automatons. And those are going to go streaming out of the star. Right? Right, and, you know, and a flood to begin with, you know, right, you know, but the, you know, in the sense, you know, it's a leak relative to the total mass of the object, obviously. It isn't like poof and, you know, solar mass disappears. So it's a leakage in relative terms, but in, you know, in absolute terms, if you will, I mean, you know, in terms of, you know, how many particles per second, it's a huge number. You know, automatons. You know, see, so that's it. They're pointing out in those early stages, you can get a huge flux of automatons coming out of a star, just like we talked about uncharged, you know, an automaton is an uncharged particle, just like we talked about those uncharged electron neutrinos coming out in the previous section during that supernova explosion. All right, and that issue of early on, when things might not be very hyper-dense, and if you liberate automatons, they're not going to be perhaps kind of in a tight coupled system. It's a looser system. Things haven't gotten very hyper-dense yet, and so they're just going to go streaming out. The star is going to be essentially transparent to those little automatons moving at the speed of light, and they're just going to go streaming out of the center of the star. After whatever unraveled was unraveled. And they mentioned that back in section 4 when they said they were talking about stars getting to the point where they might be quite dense, still gaseous, but quite dense, like, you know, even iron-like density. And they mentioned such suns have also largely lost their free automatonic stores of energy. See, so, you know, they're, you know, these two, put these two together. It's when it's getting more dense like that, they aren't going to be so free, those automatons. They're going to be more coupled in. They're not going to be so free to just go screaming out and off into space. You know, so that's why they were saying that. The star is old enough that it's not in this early mode that they're referring to here finally now in this section, where they, when they're liberated, they, off they go. So this sphere of you know, we've been referring to that has a surface in a more literal way, this ball that is this star and its tightly coupled system of motion, initially it isn't as tightly coupled. And as we referred to last time, in the late stages of a star, when the outer layers might get really puffed up, obviously those very diffuse outer regions of that big puffed up object are not going to be so tightly coupled either. So you always have this, you have to keep this in mind, that there may be times in a star's actual life when it will behave a little bit more like the kind of star we imagine right now, this gaseous, hot gaseous collection of billiard balls. It won't be so blurred together into a form of matter and a, you know, system of energy that we really don't currently imagine. And if it is out like that, if it's kind of porous, quote unquote, you know, things can get out a lot easier. All right, so that's what they're referring to there. And then notice at the end, they gave you that initial thing about you know, us being able to understand a star affecting you know, the raw material that's out there in space between the stars, those hydrogen clouds, you know, how the electronic level energy output could certainly impact the development of that matter as it's You know, it starts with ultramatons out there and then gets to collections of 100 ultramatons and then forms hydrogen atoms and bigger and bigger and bigger atoms to find the other uranium atoms and whatnot. And it finally all gets gravitationally collected into a star somewhere. And that electronic level energy could definitely be impacting that whole process of that matter's development. But even more fundamentally, see what they say at the end, these ultramaton energies escape out into space to engage in the adventure of electronic association and energy materialization as a veritable energy blast during adolescent solar times. So in order to make those atoms, starting with the smallest one of hydrogen and going to bigger ones out there in the cold, cold depths of interstellar space, we know now with the revelation, you have to start with ultramatons. You can't just start with electronic level particles and assemble them into the billiard ball atom that we have right now. You have to start with ultramatons.
Who's we?
The power directly? I was anthropomorphizing. I don't mean literally. I mean, as we think about the natural formation of atoms out there, you have to picture a scenario that starts with a raw material of ultramatons, not a raw material of electronic level particles. And so you could ask the question, and I don't know if you've ever thought about this, I mean, some of you certainly know that the Revelation talks about that building up from ultramatons. We'll get to the curious huddling proclivity and stuff like that. But you know, did you ever ask yourself, well, where do those ultramatons come from? Well, when they talk about forming whirls in the force charge, you know, getting a spiral nebula going, you know, in that context, we talk about where you start with the force charge, and then the primary force organizers set up the whirl, and that's a you're starting a condensation process, and then the associate ones step in next, and they foster that condensation further, and that whirl literally condenses into ultramatons. And that whirl in the force charge condenses into ultramatons. And so a spiral nebula is starting out with its raw ultramatonic material, with those ultramatons that condensed out of that whirl. And the more ultramatons condensed, the less there's a whirl. Until finally there's no whirl left in the force charge. It's all condensed into ultramatons. And the ultramatons have combined into collections of 100, et cetera. And you've built atoms and molecules and whatnot out of them. Well, how does this process keep going? You could imagine using up all that initial raw material that you condensed out of that whirl. Well, see, here's how you get it back. You know, they build up into big atoms, and then those atoms go down into the center of stars and get unraveled back into free ultramatons that can get out very easily, at least in the early stages of the star, and repopulate. See, so it's just this endless recycling process. You know, the ultramatons are, you know, in finite terms, eternal. They can't be created or destroyed by any finite process. So they just go around and around in this recycling process. Build up, and tear apart. Build up, tear apart. All right, so that's the answer to having an ongoing supply. Now, of course, an interesting thing is, you know, is when the grand universe is eventually settled in light and life, all these finite processes like that come to an end, and all the ultramatons are bottled up. You don't have any fundamental things leaking out of Havona worlds. I mean, you don't even have any fundamental things leaking out of architectural spheres. You have a whole new transcendent process that we can't even imagine that's going to perpetuate the absinite ages of things, and you know, some recycling process in absinite cycles. But here, For long ages, you're just recycling these automatons, using them and reusing them, and then eventually at some point they're all going to get locked down. And then the finite will come to an end. All right. So in just a little microcosm in that paragraph, you saw what we saw with the juxtaposition of the previous two sections. Remember how I pointed out, that's the classic pairing where they say, now here is what's actually going on from a revelatory context. And then they follow that by, now here's how you think about it, with a little tweaking on our part to suggest, how you could expand upon that, improve upon that, etc. Compare to what we said before, those sorts of things. You see it here just a little in a little microcosm, a little bit of kind of, you can understand these sorts of things, but there's something parallel to that, more fundamental in the second half of the paragraph. Same pattern. They do it over and over and over again. So you can always look for that pattern. Here's the way it really is. Here's how you think about it. Now, you follow up. They want you to produce at least as much deduced material to combine with the pure revelatory material. At least as much as there is pure revelatory material. To combine it together, it's got to be, it's going to be at least a 50-50 construct like that in order to get the full picture that they want you to get out of the revelation. If you don't properly follow their suggestions on what to do with what you currently have, you're going to be missing half the picture. You can't just construct a true science out of merely what's immediately in the revelation, even if you've properly recognized that you've cut through all of your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, and are actually seeing the revelation as they want you to see it. Even then, you still have a lot of work to do in order to get something that you can genuinely take forward with integrity. You can't just do it with the initial revelatory content.
Why do you think they were allowed to tell us about automatons at this stage? You're right. It'd be hard to go through all this if they didn't. But it seems like it worked quite a ways off from.
Right. I mean, that's
even thinking about.
Right. It's not that we couldn't eventually get to an automatonic science. But it's the case that, without revelatory help, think about how long it would be. I mean, even with Adamic, an Adam and Eve on a world helping the people, it takes them 25,000 years to get those people, through the evolutionary process, encouraging those people to get them from no science to an automatonic science.
And
they started out on a fine foundation of a planetary prince and his staff and everything. Yeah, right. So even with very direct, help, it's a 25,000 year process. How long would it take us with no help? We are, like you're saying, we are so lost in the opposite direction right now. We think that to seek out more fundamental phenomena, we need to go to bigger electronic level energies. We produce these particle accelerators to try to go farther and farther up in electronic level energy above the foundation of the electronic level. And that's where we think fundamentality lies. We're literally going in the opposite direction. You don't want to go up from the electronic level. You want to go down from the electronic level to the sub-electronic. That's where the fundamental things lie.
Could you explain that further? Because I'll bet there are a lot of people that don't really understand that. People understand, the Hadron Collider as something that would be trying to break things up into smaller pieces. That would be the popular notion.
Yeah.
What are you saying?
In terms of current rationalization schemes of what's more fundamental than, say, a proton, and why would you want to put a proton in some sort of a smasher to figure out what it's made out of. You know, the current rationalization scheme is that that proton is made out of three quarks. And you go, okay, well, I mean, is that kind of getting at least in the proper direction towards 100 ultimatons in a particle? I mean, it's only three, but it's more than one. You know, is it something? Is it some measure of progress? Well, if they just tell you that, you might think so. And then, but then you look into the details and you go, well, wait a minute. The energies, you know, the masses, you know, of these three particles that supposedly go to make up the proton, they're much more massive than the proton. They have a greater electronic level energy than the proton. Huh? All right. See, but in a fanciful mathematics that they have right now, it does quote unquote add up. But it's obviously it doesn't just simply add. You know, you don't take 50 plus 50 plus 50 and get one. You know, unless you do quantum mechanics.
What they end up with, they consider more stable because it's less energetic.
Let's not go in. There's all kinds of complexities about why they believe what they believe about it. But just see, that's the they think that that you're to write it, to really get the more fundamental phenomenon, you have to produce these higher and higher energies. Because the more fundamental particle, something they would call a Higgs boson or a God particle, all these sorts of things, see, they're very, very high electronic level energy, much, massively higher than the fundamental particles of electrons, protons, neutrons, things like that. They're going in the complete opposite direction, and spending billions and billions of dollars trying to go further and further in the incorrect direction. You know, what they're seeking is not something that has a bigger E, capital E, electronic level energy. They're seeking something that has less than zero, quote unquote. I mean, the sub-electronic domain doesn't have any electronic level energy. It's an energy, it's a differential relative to the force charge, but it's not an electronic level differential. It's not anything that you measure with current instruments. It's not a kind of differential that you measure with current instruments. It's not a kind of a differential that manifests as a mass or manifests as a charge or anything like that. It's a more fundamental energy, but an energy nonetheless, a differential nonetheless. Even that whirl in the force charge is an energy, is a differential from the smoothness of the background of the force charge. You know, there's a whirl here and not over there. Therefore, there's a differential. If I picture two, probes on some measuring device, I can stick one in the whirl and one in the not whirl, and I'm going to get a differential, measuring on my meter of some sort. But with a force charge, there is no such thing. It's exactly the same everywhere. So it doesn't matter where you put two probes into it. You know, you get no differential on your differential meter. All right, so that's, That's what we're trying to understand is that you have this whole more fundamental domain of differentials that all go down to a fundamental individuated differential, an ultimaton, and relative to a basic electronic level state of matter, that ultimaton is just going to go through it like nothing, there's nothing there. In the same way that an electron neutrino, because it doesn't have a charge or a mass, will go through an awful lot of electronic level matter as if it wasn't there. I mean, how much more is the ultimaton going to go through that electronic level matter, like the Earth, say, as if it's not there? But you get those really intense states of physical, physical system, a system of motion, after the early stages of the star, and that ultimaton is not going to see a transparent environment. You know, it's going to find itself locked into some tighter system. Even those electron neutrinos are going to feel themselves like, you know, they're going to be, you know, trapped in there and get unraveled, because they're a collection of 100 ultimatons, and they'll just get unraveled into ultimatons too. But you get some sort of a collapsing situation where it's basically transparent above them, and you generate a bunch of them, and they go streaming out. But if they don't have a window, you know, an out, you know, they're just going to be trapped in there and get unraveled, just like everything else is getting unraveled.
Yeah, yeah. So the we talked about the ultimatons in this case being recycled.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they have to start somewhere to get recycled to begin with. So remember when they talked in the book about two beings pull apart and begin to get the world going?
Right, that's what I was saying. That, I mentioned this. See, that's how the initial ultimatons that start...
That's how they initially start.
Right, there's you
out the, of energy, the, out of some, the,
you start with a force charge, the primordial force.
Right.
You quote unquote condense that into a whirl, and you further condense that whirl into ultimatons. And it takes the two types of beings. The primary ones go from the force charge to the whirl. The associate ones go from the whirl to the ultimatons. They're condensing force into energy.
And
that's how you have the initial set. Right, that's how you have the initial set of ultimatons. Yep, yep. And so, even though by and large the Milky Way galaxy is a collection of small worlds that have been brought in, you know, and create this collection. Obviously, there's a whirl to the Milky Way galaxy also. See, so a lot of ultimatons that are being used, you know, in that recycling process. We're not started up in some little Andronover-like whirl, but we're, you know, coalesced out of an initial Milky Way-sized whirl. Just like out in the outer space levels, you all have all those Milky Way-sized whirls, like the Andromeda Nebula and the millions of other, you know, big spiral nebulae like that. You know, those are gigantic collections of ultimatons that are getting started out of those condensing whirls to get some really big recycling process going. I mean, you just have seven big galaxies for the whole, you know, super universe level. That's a lot of ultimatons, you know, and just numbers, but not like the number of ultimatons that are being produced for whatever they're going to do in the outer space levels. Right? It's peanuts in here in comparison. Right? So there's going to be a huge recycling process. And that's the whole question about what happens with ultimatons and all this sort of stuff when you transcend into the absonite. I mean, I don't understand how this all works. But, I mean, right now, you're just, when we're talking about ultimatons, we're talking about the finite footprint of an ultimaton. Now, it has a deeper nature. You know, it goes all the way down to the co-absolute, you know, and is centered upon the absoluteness of the aisle. You know, so whether or not it's simply a matter of in the absonite ages, you will have those ultimatons manifesting their absonite nature, sort of what's below the surface of the water right now, you know, the part of the iceberg that's below the surface of the water right now. Is it as simple as that? Or, you know, is it something that no one really can imagine right now, that you just have a totally different, you know, setup? They're used in a totally different way or something. I mean, who knows? Remember, the Revelators don't know such things. Not even Michael knows such things, really. I mean, so there's deep mystery there. But nonetheless, all right, so that's what we're talking about in this first paragraph, is just appreciating that what we really want these stars to do relative to that environment is not just electronic X-ray excitation stuff or anything like that. We want them to spew out ultimatons so we can get the process going again. And if stars don't do it enough, that's where the secondary dissociators come in, those master physical controllers that we mentioned recently. If you've got a whole bunch of ultimatons locked up in this solid object and it's just going to sit there for, you know, a quintillion years, if someone doesn't do something to it, they go in there and unravel it. you know, because you need a certain amount of free ultimatons, free, to keep the cycle going. All right. I think that's it, isn't it? Yeah, let's get some more here.
Atoms and electrons are subject to gravity. The ultimatons are not subject to local gravity, the interplay of material attraction, but they are fully obedient to absolute or paradise gravity, to the trend, the swing, of the universal and eternal circle of the universe of universes. Ultimatonic energy does not obey the linear or direct gravity attraction of nearby or remote material masses, but it does ever swing true to the circuit of the great ellipse of the far-flung creation.
Okay. Start with this, the main thing that ties into the previous paragraph. The ultimatons are not subject, you know, to local gravity, i.e. what we began to understand as Newtonian gravity, linear gravity. And we've expanded a little bit with our rationalization scheme of general relativity to include things that don't literally have a mass, like a photon. So that we basically have some kind of a rationalization scheme now for all of those electronic, you know, level particles. One way or another, we can understand what we basically observe them doing, like a train of photons, its path being apparently bent as it goes by a large mass, those sorts of things, even though they don't literally have a mass, but they behave as if they did. And we have a rationalization scheme for that now. But the subelectronic is a totally different matter. You don't have that collection of 100 ultimatons, and the motion interaction that it plays in that we call linear gravity anymore. So that's just not there. Definitely not there when you go literally all the way down to the ultimaton. So yes, the ultimaton is a little spherical manifestation, very, very tiny spherical manifestation, but it doesn't have any electronic level properties like charge or mass. You know, it's way removed from any properties like that. Even the raw collection of 100 ultimatons doesn't have charge or mass. You've got to add energy upon that before you have charge or mass. So the ultimaton, you know, doesn't feel any sort of a gravity pull as it's trying to escape that leakage, you know, we were just reading about. It doesn't feel any sort of an influence from the charge or the mass or the any whatnot, that's going on inside that star or relative to it as you get outside of the star. You know, it isn't struggling, needing some escape velocity to get away from it or anything like that. Okay. However, it does experience, as they're talking about, you know, what they will often call absolute or paradise gravity or circular gravity or various designations like that. So let's just remind ourselves again of the specifics there. In terms of literally, directly, the influence of the Isle of Paradise on the ultimaton, that isn't what they're talking about there. The Isle directly is just the centering influence that makes this finite manifestation be a spherical manifestation. Okay? The Isle of Paradise is an absolute fact, cannot have any scale relationship to the master universe. It can't treat a big scale different than a small scale or anything like that. It's scale independent. It's, you know, it's absolutely independent of such finite geometry issues as bigness or smallness, you know, in a finite sense. So all, you know, it just has a point influence. Every point in finite space has a centering influence. The aisle, speaking in absolute terms at that point, you finite phenomenon, orient yourself perfectly, symmetrically about my centering influence. When they're talking like they are here, you know, it's a little bit in quotes, absolute or paradise gravity. It's that absolute or paradise gravity downstepped through the dark gravity bodies. Right? So bringing it from the absinite, from the absolute through the absinite, the dark gravity bodies, into relationship with the finite. Not directly relating the absolute to the finite, but channeling that influence through the dark gravity bodies. Now, those very special objects that are around the central universe. In that very strange arrangement. Right? I mean, they have an elliptical, pancake-like arrangement. So when you go through the fact of those dark gravity bodies, what comes out as a transfinite influence has a planar, roughly planar, elliptical-like expression. So, you know, you set an ultiproton free out of one of these stars. Does it go in a straight line away from that star forever until it hits the boundary of the master universe or whatever, you know, boundary you want to think of? No, it's not that free that it can just go on a straight line. As soon as it's, out, quote-unquote, free in the super universe level, it's part of the flow in the super universe level, the counterclockwise flow. You know, so if the central universe is a circular table here next to me, you know, if something is, you know, moving outward relative to the central universe in the super universe level where I'm sitting here, if it's moving outward, it doesn't just go straight radially outward like maybe you initiated it. It's going to slowly bend northward, clockwise. Okay, you know, and obviously you could have something that literally, you know, just go counterclockwise. If I said clockwise, counterclockwise, it's going to bend counterclockwise. You know, and you could obviously have something that literally, you know, went around the bend of the ages, you know, as it were. You know, so starlight that's coming in from the outer space levels, you know, goes through this process. It's drifting counterclockwise in the second outer space level, and then it's drifting clockwise in the first outer space level, and then it's drifting counterclockwise again in the super universe level before it gets to our telescope. It doesn't go in a straight line path. All right, so that, you know, that's usually what they're talking about when they're talking about absolute gravity. It's kind of in quotes a little bit. You know, it's channeled through the dark gravity body so that it produces this elliptical level phenomenon. All right, so that's what they're referring to there. The ultimaton definitely, will feel that influence, but not anything that's like Newtonian gravity, nothing that's, you know, between two points in the finite sort of an influence. All right.
Yep. Central universe elliptical.
Yeah, central universe is elliptical. And if you want to, you know, the more you think about this, the more you recognize not only their description of the geometry of the central universe, but their description of the geometry of the aisle itself. See, none of that description is transfinite. Yeah. They can't give you the absolute geometry of the aisle. That doesn't mean anything to us, and you'll never experience it. I mean, you know, what an absinite being experiences on the aisle? See, is an interesting question. But it's, you know, basically, you know, when they tell you the geometry of the central universe and the geometry of the aisle, they're giving you the geometry of the projection. You know, down into finite terms Even you know, with the aisle, I mean, it's, you know, think about it, you know, when you're up there on the aisle touching it, you're not actually touching its absoluteness. You can't do that. You're touching some sort of a finite skin, if you will. And that finite skin, you know, is pancake-shaped and elliptical. But what it is in absolute terms is not knowable. You know, so you're always just touching the outside and wondering what it would be like if your hand could sink deeper. You know, what the master architect's hand? How does it experience the geometry? Is it still pancake shaped and stuff, or is it different? You know, what does the central universe look like to the architects? Yeah, they would see it in absolute geometry. Who knows what that looks like? Not to mention, you know, from someone who is actually an absolute being, the absolute, you know, phenomena in the outer space levels isn't a future, you know, picture. It's already there. You know, so all that stuff of looking at it from the top down is, you know, basically very confusing in many ways to try to think about.
We got a long way but, to go.
Right. But anyway.
There's a comment on the webinar. Marge said, Ultimatons only responsive to paradise gravity, analogous to thought adjusters' relationship with personality fusion. And she's getting that from a quote. She said, she put in, we know that thought adjusters are spirits, pure spirits, presumably absolute spirits, but the adjuster must also be something more than exclusive spirit reality. Mm-hmm. In addition to conjectured mindedness, factors of pure energy are also present. If you will remember that God is the source of pure energy and of pure spirit, it will not be so difficult to perceive that his fragments would be both.
Right.
It is a fact that the adjusters traverse space over the instantaneous and universal gravity circuits of the Paradise Isle.
Right. But that, you know, that's pure energy. And that's a use of the word energy that's transcendent of even what we've just been using it for. You know, I refer to that all the time. You know, remember the what they're telling you there, that the adjuster is not only pure spirit but pure energy, is that if you put all the father fragments out in front of you, you know, in your mind's eye, you have all these quote unquote pure spirit, you know, purely spirit fragments. And their individuations. But if you turn them around, they're the force charge of space. Pure energy, quote unquote, is the primordial force. It's the force charge of space. Those, you know, to understand that, you know, if nothing else, from the perspective of the Father, there's no difference between the force charge of space and the thought adjusters. They're the same fact. That's pretty mind-boggling. Remember, it's, you know, from our perspective, they couldn't be more removed. One is all the way to the one end of the spectrum, and the other is all the way to the other end. But in reality, of course, it wraps around. You know, it's not they're not on a line; they're on an elliptical closure, philosophically, and. You know, to look all the way to one end, you know, and saying flipping around is to look the other direction and just see the other side of it, you know, in its circular fashion. And so, see, that's, you know, the force charge is more fundamental than an ultimaton. You know, and that it also reminds you, I mean, right now we think of the force charge as being, having no sort of direct finite nature, that it's really an absonite fact that casts a shadow in the finite. But if it's going to be really the opposite side of all the father fragments, It's a lot more fundamental than absinthe. And so that's just another one of those. All this stuff has very deep roots. They get more confusing the more you try to understand them. Right? But just, you know, just let's just stick with this. I mean, so, you know, when you're thinking about all the matons, you're thinking about something that's more downstepped than a thought adjuster, more downstepped than the force charge. An automaton, you know, if we watched one move through space, we would describe it moving at the speed of light, at that unit speed. A thought adjuster doesn't move at the speed of light. Yeah, it moves at infinite speed. So it doesn't have that kind of embedding into the finite that would force, you know, even its shadow, quote unquote, to only pass by me at the speed of light. Its shadow passes by me at infinite speed. You see, it doesn't really cast a shadow into the finite. It's completely above, even in any sort of tenuous shadow-like sense. The first time that the adjuster has a direct relationship to the finite level is when it fuses with you. Yeah. Before that, it's above the finite. You're reaching up to where it is. It's reaching down, but it can only reach down to the supreme level, and you've got to get the rest of the way up to its lowest reach at the supreme level. And when you fuse with it, you drag part of it down into the finite for the first time. But until that, it's above the finite. And that's why its effective speed is infinite. But, after you fuse with your adjuster, you don't zip around the universe at infinite speed.
Come on.
It doesn't, it now can't go any faster than, what the laws of the finite, allow. So you put your big boat anchor, hanging on that adjuster for eternity after that point. Yep. All right. But here, I was using the elliptical picture, but here we're talking about literally the geometry ellipse of the master universe when they say the circuit of the great ellipse of the far-flung creation. Okay, let's keep going here.
Your own solar center radiates almost 100 billion tons of actual matter annually, while the giant suns lose matter at a prodigious rate during their earlier growth, the first billion years. A sun's life becomes stable after the maximum of internal temperature is reached and the subatomic energies begin to be released. And it is just at this critical point that the larger suns are given to convulsive pulsations.
And that maximum internal temperature, when they say subatomic, they mean all the way. Not only subatomic, but subelectronic, I mean all the way down to ultimatonic. Now, the one interesting little science item in there is, if you know anything about the sun, and I was just alluding to it earlier, we know about the solar wind, we've started measuring a lot. We make estimates about how much, you notice how they say actual matter? So electronic level stuff is flying away from the sun in the solar wind. And so when you see them telling you how much, remember the revelatory mandate. They can't tell you that if you can figure that out well yourself. So what's your guess? When we figure it out, when we deduce how much matter is, leaving the sun annually, do you suppose it's really close to that number? No, it's not.
Short of that number?
We get a number that's a lot bigger than that. In our estimate. So that's a very fascinating little data point. I mean, just to give you an idea of how much smaller this is than what you would be expecting from current deductions. The current estimate of how much matter is leaving annually, you know, it's a lot bigger than that. If you pare that down to how much leaves per day in the current estimate, you get this number. It's off by 365.2425.
Are you sure the S&P people didn't change that?
quite a bit different. Quite a bit different. So that's a fun little challenge. See, they've given you a little something there to, as you work on this more, you're going to start to feel like maybe you don't know exactly what it is. I wonder what it is. You know, they've actually given it to you. I mean, obviously, it's a pretty tricky thing to figure out. It's not like we collect every single electron and proton and whatnot that's leaving, and you know, put them all in a balance and weigh them. You know, you measure a handful and extrapolate. Yeah, obviously, room for all kinds of extrapolation. So they're actually giving you that number. Now, the other thing that's interesting about that number is, remember back when we were talking about that really old star that they were referring to and how it was 60,000 times as dense as the sun, and we were noticing that they said that it started out about the mass of the sun and it's very, after all those endless years of its life, had boiled down to something that was somewhere in the 4 to 5 hundredths of a solar mass range. And we're going, well, whoa, where did all that mass go? He said, well, you know, put trillions of years in play with a solar wind and you'll dissipate, you know, even as much mass as a star is, you know, even one relatively small like ours. Well, you know, you can do a quick little calculation here. Remember they told you, that our sun is about 2 octillion tons, 2 × 10^27 tons. Okay, here you have 100 billion tons per year. Okay, so in other words, you have 10^11 tons per year. What if I took 10^11 years, or 10^12 years, or 10^14 years? 11. Eleven and 11 is only 22. That's pretty short of 27. Let's say it was 10 trillion. Okay, so you'd have 10^13. Well, that's still just 11 plus 13, 24. That's still quite a bit short of 27.
Doing
age here. Okay. All right, so just notice if you do, let's see, a little back of the envelope, it's like, okay, if you're going to get it down to basically where you've evaporated a whole solar mass away, a whole 10^27 tons, you're going to need a lot more than just tens of trillions of years. You know, the universe is not going to be old enough again. Oh, okay, so obviously I can't just extrapolate this number. It's going to be losing more early or late or whatnot. Well, they already mentioned that you lose a whole bunch of it. You know, a lot of that mass gets unraveled, the ultimatons, and the ultimatons just go streaming away. And, you know, so, yeah, just note that gets you in this same mode where it doesn't seem like there's, even if you make the universe 300 trillion years old, you're running out of age of the universe to make a star boil, evaporate. Okay, so little things like that are reminding you about the dangers of making simple extrapolations. You know, things are not constant with time. Just because it's 100 billion tons right now per year doesn't mean it's always that way. And you can see it can't be, or things just wouldn't work like they just described that they do. All right. You know, notice they mentioned the giant suns lose matter at a prodigious rate during those first billion years. And they're about to give you a little more sense of that. As they say that at the end there, when things start to kick on, I mean, you can imagine you've got a whole bunch of matter that's just slowly gravitationally condensing, getting hotter and hotter and hotter. And then, you know, when you light the, you know, the actual unraveling process there in the center, you've got this very profound internal energy generation source in the midst of this collapsing phenomenon. And the thing is likely going to puff out, and then it's going to want to fall back in. You know, obviously, the thing is going to go through some sort of an unstable process, probably, until it finally gets in equilibrium with this huge energy release that you have at the center of it now. You know, it's not just because you're squeezing a gas into a smaller and smaller volume, and it's heating up, and it could be kind of stable as it slowly goes through that process. All of a sudden, you kick in this whole new process, and so it's got to come into a new equilibrium with that profound energy source at the center. So how does it do that? Well, here's what they're going to talk about here.
Sun stability is wholly dependent on the equilibrium between gravity heat contention. Tremendous pressures counterbalanced by unimagined temperatures. The interior gas elasticity of the suns upholds the overlying layers of varied materials. And when gravity and heat are in equilibrium, the weight of the outer materials exactly equals the temperature pressure of the underlying and interior gases. In many of the younger stars, continued gravity condensation produces ever-heightening internal temperatures, and as internal heat increases, the interior X-ray pressure of supergas winds becomes so great that, in connection with the centrifugal motion, a sun begins to throw its exterior layers off into space, thus redressing the imbalance between gravity and heat.
Okay, so take kind of the extreme example, you know, that it's in play here. They told you that a stable star can't be bigger than 30 solar masses. Well, obviously, I mean, there's just all kinds of matter all over. I mean, you could start a collection that's a lot bigger than 30 solar masses out of one of these giant hydrogen clouds. You know, if that's not good, and that won't produce, you know, if it ends up being 100 solar masses, that's not going to be something that can chug along for billions and trillions of years as some stable phenomenon. It has to somehow get itself pared down to 30 or less. Okay, so, you know, that's one of the main things that they're describing right there. That, see, this is you get ever heightening internal temperatures. When you finally, you know, actually kick the, you know, reach the electronic boiling point at the center and kick off this primary stellar generation phenomenon, it has to get into an equilibrium state, and if it has more than 30 solar masses, I mean, you're just going to be sloughing off, you know, the majority of that to get it pared down to 30 or less, you know, in a very, you know, extreme early stage of development. So, you know, when we look out at stars, you know, we see some that are in this mode where they're putting off huge amounts of matter. See, so you could say, I wonder if it's a star in this mode, where it's trying to get itself pared down to 30. You know, current science allows stars to be heavier than 30 and be a stable stellar phenomenon. But the revelers are saying no. So, you know, expect to find some stars that are going to be putting out huge amounts of matter. And they're in this very early stage. They started with just way too much. And they're going to have a huge cloud of stuff flowing out from them in these early stages until they finally get down to 30 or less. So, you know, that's, if you know, if you've ever taken an astronomy course, you might even be thinking of some things like that. Okay, I don't want to go into all those details. But the other thing, though, about this is, and they keep reminding you of this, this whole process of establishing an equilibrium, it's not in a domain like we currently think is in the interior of a star. It's what they keep calling a super gas. See that super gas winds they were talking about there? We're going to get to that in the next paper. You have this sub-electronic energy system, you know, this tightly coupled system that we've been talking about building up that produces a super gas, quote unquote. And it's going to have phenomena that are different than we currently imagine. When we currently think about the equilibrium of a star, I've mentioned it a couple times. It's a basic picture where you have an internal pressure, and there's a pressure gradient. And obviously, the pressure drops as you go out from the center of the star. That pressure gradient, that's one force. The other force is the force of gravity in the opposite direction. That pressure gradient and that gravitational force balance, and you have an equilibrium where it's not expanding or contracting. It has some equilibrium radius. That's the basic way that currently a star is understood to be stable. A current scientist reading this paragraph will go, I don't know if the person who wrote this understands, and they seem to be saying it's like a pressure and not a pressure gradient and various things like this. Without getting lost in the details, the revelators, I'm sure, are saying things the way they are, a little bit not what you would expect from the billiard ball model stability, you know, where you're basically just using Newton's second law, F equals ma, you know, and this sort of stuff to understand your billiard balls being in a static arrangement. You know, the actual way that it comes into an equilibrium is going to be much more complicated because it's a state of matter that's a lot different than we currently imagine. So that's, I'm sure, why they say things in sort of a non sequitur way like they do. So that it kind of sounds okay, but probably if you actually understood the physics, the actual physics, you go, oh, I see what they did. So it's actually like this. And they were saying it in a way that was kind of like we used to think about it, but allowed for the actual way that it's stable. I'm sure that's what they're doing. There are people who have, over the decades, have fixated on this paragraph and dismissed the Urantia book as being, you know, ignorant because it doesn't say it the way it should say it, you know, about the stability. And that's why I'm dwelling on that a little bit. Anyway, the key is just, you know, throwing in the super gas word. That's how they're reminding you to not go off on that false tangent, like so many skeptics of the revelation have with those statements. All right. You know, and again, see, mentioning that interior X-ray pressure. Remember, you've got this waves in the force charge, this tightly coupled system. See, none of that is in the current science. Okay, let's see. Anything else there? I mean, just, you know, maybe just so you can appreciate kind of just on a rudimentary level that why a star would pulsate like this in the early stages, you know, you can just think about it simply. I mean, I'm squeezing something and it's heating up, you know, and then it finally is hot enough where it you know, can overcome the squeeze I'm putting on it and puffs it back out again, but then it cools off, and so then it collapses again. And I mean, you can understand just a simple oscillation in just a simple ideal gas sort of sense of, you know, it heats when you compresses it and cools when you expand it, you know. So you can understand why it might be not a fixed radius early on and oscillating some like that. And then you just add in the more complicated physics that they're alluding to get the details of exactly how it oscillates and you know, why it is that it can't be stable if it's more than 30 and all that sort of stuff. Okay. All right.
Your own sun has long since attained relative equilibrium between its expansion and contraction cycles. Those disturbances which produce the gigantic pulsations of many of the younger stars. Your sun is now passing out of its 6 billionth year. At the present time, it is functioning through the period of greatest economy. It will shine on as of present efficiency for more than 25 billion years. It will probably experience a partially efficient period of decline as long as the combined periods of its youth and stabilized function.
As long, see, as those two together, the 6 billion plus the little more than 25 billion. Okay, now two things here. Okay, so as we've been talking about all this stuff, we keep throwing out trillions and trillions of years for the ages of stars. Okay, all right, so notice the first thing, going, well, wait a minute, this is just lots of billions. Okay, you've got a number of things in play. Remember when we went through the list of seven ways that you generate energy? When a star is, the run-of-the-mill star is in its mainline mode, where the unraveling particles is the primary energy source, the energy that comes from being encircuited is way down there, number six, in that list. And remember, in the wake of that, they talked about such solar furnaces blaze on indefinitely, if they've actually been plugged in, quote unquote, if they're encircuited. Okay, so you've got it's one thing to know that a star could go on not just trillions of years, but indefinitely, forever, for eternity. Plugged in. Okay, so billions of years is just completely irrelevant to that. I mean, technically, our star, doesn't have any billions of years associated with it. It's going to be here, forever. It's an eternal object once it's encircuited.
Well, funny that they didn't conjecture that when they were
right. Okay, I'm going to burrow in. That's one thing to keep in mind. Okay, now another thing is, when you say trillions and trillions of years, okay, that's over the whole span of a star. And even a small one will go on a long time as that cooling, condensing object becoming solid. Remember, we talked about that, that you can get trillions and trillions of years just from that whole, everything from initially starting it as a condensing domain of gas into finally having a cinder. Now, another thing is, if you have a lot more material than our star, obviously it'll go for a lot longer. Remember, they referred to that when they talked about red ones and yellow ones, and then they said, but the brilliant white light signifies robust and extended adult life. If you have a lot more matter than a solar mass, you're not going to go through that as quickly. 10 times more, maybe it takes 10 times as long, to go through it. Okay, so you could get up into, speculating just in simple extrapolation to a trillion or 2 years of a kind of a mainline thing if you just had a lot more mass in play than our star does. Okay. So all that is valid. What they're doing here is they're focusing a little bit more on what we understand about our star, or the way we think about our sun. And this gets into your question that you asked at the beginning. If you ask a current scientist to extrapolate forward with our current stellar interior theory, how long the sun is going to last, You know, they'll say things like, well, it stays on as a main sequence star, you know, sort of the main phenomenon of a star not puffing up into a red giant or anything, for 9 billion or 10 billion years or something like that. Okay, so that's one thing. But more to the point of what they're saying here is, if you asked him, how long can we expect our star to basically stay just like it is right now and have the Earth be, you know, habitable the same way it is right now? You say, well, that's a pretty short time span. You know, I say, if you go a billion years in the future, you'll say this planet will be completely uninhabitable. Because the sun will have, they think that the sun is slowly expanding, heading towards that red giant stage on a pretty relatively small time scale, short time scale. You know, and they think it will have expanded enough, in other words, its luminosity will have gone up enough in just a billion years that it'll boil the oceans away. Okay, so that's the important number to compare to what they're saying here. How long, you know, would the sun support life as it is right now in the current theory? Not even a billion years. They say, trivially, over 25 billion, without a lick of change. Okay, and relatively not that much change going on another, you know, 30, 31, 32 or whatever. Okay, that's the thing you want to compare there, is just how far off we are. And these numbers are giving you is if nothing is put into the star. If you just imagining it isolated like we think of our sun being isolated, and just letting it burn through its solar mass, it's going to be pretty much out of the mode we see it in right now. After, you know, what is that, 56, 57 billion years. Okay. Not less than a billion. But then, you know, it'll go on for ages after that. You know, it ends up being trillions and trillions of years, even if you just, this wasn't an inhabited system and you just let it finally become a cinder. You know, it'd go on as a very significant star for a long time after, you know, those, you know, 30-some billion years. It's just that the environment on this planet would start to be radically different than it is right now. Okay. That's what they're getting at, you know. So that's the difference of bringing in item number one in the energy generation instead of just having item number two in the current billiard ball model. Instead of having a billion, you have, you know, many, many times more than a billion before you'd have much of any significant change. It's a very deep well, okay? Now, the way they say that, when they say it will, first they say it will shine on as a present efficiency, and then it will probably experience. When they're doing that, they're saying, well, the issue is why it says will probably in this thought experiment. I mean, it definitely won't. I mean, we're going to be in circuited. I mean, we're going to be settled deep in light and life long before 25 billion years is up. Okay, so it's, you know, it's just a thought experiment. But what they're saying is, it's a little hard for them to project exactly what kind of raw material it might start to come in. You know, if you just let it go. Remember what they said in those things, the accumulation and transmission of certain universal space energies, space matter and meteors, et cetera. There's all these things that can feed into a star that would extend its life dramatically. You know, and so that's why they say, well, probably, you know, it's like, if you assumed, and they think, if you just let it go, it probably wouldn't end up picking up very much. So it'd pretty much kind of just go with what it has. That's what they're getting at there. It's just a thought experiment of if you let it play itself out like you think your star is going to play itself out. Yeah, it will eventually play itself out, and this planet would become uninhabitable. But it's a vastly longer timescale than you think. because of item number one in the list of energy generation.
So how old does science think our sun is now?
Well, they, you know, they have these very simplistic ideas about the formation of the solar system, you know, so they, you know, they'll say something like 4.5 billion or 5 billion. Okay, it's actually 6. And the closeness of that is just a coincidence. I mean, that's, it's a completely spurious assumption that leads them to the 4.5 or 5. That's an issue for when we get to part 3. but coincidentally, the random number that we've picked that we don't think is a random number is not that far from 6 billion. All right. Okay. So that's the thing to appreciate there. You can't take this paragraph out of the context of back here in paper 15 when it says the trillions upon trillions of years that an ordinary sun will continue to give out heat and light, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. I mean, that still holds. You know. So you have to interpret what they're saying here in the correct context. And like I said, I mean, it's one of the ways that you can have yourself in the context I just described is appreciating what we currently know about stars and how we think about stars and how we extrapolate with stars. And they're obviously in that mode and speaking to those thoughts and saying, well, yes, but not quite. And okay, that's what they're doing. And it's a little bit of, you currently think of it like this, well, actually, you know, the closest you can get to thinking about it like you is a lot more than a billion years. It's tens of billions, and right, the timescales are just, no matter how you look at it, are much bigger. And then throw in the power beings and the artificial things, and all of that is irrelevant. I mean, how deeply settled in light and life are we going to be 10 billion years from now? I mean, so these things are just moot. I mean, in the fifth stage of light and life is when they're completely taking control of every automaton and everything. So, you know, you don't even have to get to the seventh stage of light and life. You know, and this is really not applicable anymore. You know, the fifth stage is when they take a hold of everything. And so, you know, if they're taking hold of the Earth as they describe in the fifth stage like that, I mean, they're obviously taking hold of the sun. They can't have the sun doing random things if they're starting to micromanage the Earth. You know, this automaton goes here, this automaton goes here. I mean, you can't have the sun doing random burps of energy and whatnot. So, I mean, everything will just be totally locked down in the fifth stage of light and life. So. All right. So, to wrap it up here then, like I said, they bring it on home a little bit. I live on an inhabited planet, an inhabited world, you should be saying to yourself. And how does all of this bear upon me? They give you a little synopsis of the things that they describe in detail up there in part 3, as we were just alluding to, when they talk about the formation of the solar system. So in some ways, it's a synopsis of that. And so the fact that in some ways it's repeating what they say up there at the beginning of part 3 further emphasizes what I said at the beginning. You know, they're going to burn a whole section here for our sake. I mean, it's important. You know, they're telling you that they're willing to repeat themselves a little bit for your sake to try to help you to put yourself in the context of all this complicated stuff of that we've been talking about. So they're going to spend some time, just trying to focus it in on you a little bit more. It's important. They're willing to use that real estate in the Revelation to help you to integrate with this. So that's kind of an interesting thing. See, it's not to understand why they say the things they do in the book. It's not just kind of in a cold, hard, factual sense that we're not going to say this twice because that's wasting a sentence. Remember, they're not revealing facts, they're revealing truth in the context of coordinated essential knowledge. So they're wanting to make sure that the truth that's flowing through this paper is accessible. And if that means that they need to repeat some facts a little bit, that's okay. They're not wasting the space, see? So that's another, to always keep in mind that the primary reason that they're saying anything is to reveal truth. Okay. So what I said when we were talking about that paragraph about the 60, you know, 1,000 times density and stuff, okay, in the context of an immediate set of little, you know, subset of facts, okay, they're not going to, you know, say a sentence twice. That's ridiculous, you know, literally back to back. Because there's just, you know, a given truth flowing right through there. That would be wasting a sentence to just say it over again. But in the, you know, separated, you know, part three is way down the road from where we are right now. And it's in different modes than we're in right now. So saying some of these things, the things that they factually say up there in this context allows for a different truth than up there. Okay, so that's what they're up to here. Let's see if we can feel the closeness of it a little bit as they bring it towards us.
Section 10, Origin of Inhabited Worlds. Some of the variable stars in or near the state of maximum pulsation are in process of giving origin to subsidiary systems, many of which will eventually be much like your own sun and its revolving planets. Your sun was in just such a state of mighty pulsation when the massive Angona system swung into near approach, and the outer surface of the sun began to erupt veritable streams, continuous sheets of matter. This kept up with ever-increasing violence until nearest apposition, when the limits of solar cohesion were reached and a vast pinnacle of matter, the ancestor of the solar system, was disgorged. In similar circumstances, the closest approach of the attracting body sometimes draws off whole planets, even a quarter or third of a sun. These major extrusions form certain peculiar cloud-bound types of worlds, spheres much like Jupiter and Saturn.
Okay, now for those of you who are familiar with the description of the Angona system going by up there and beginning of part three, you notice some of the repeat here. But notice that it's not, they say some things here that they don't say up there because they have the context to say them here. They're not in the specific context of just us up there, you know, in this section. They're in a very general mode. So they can throw in things like, sometimes you have a body that passes by and causes these disruptions. And unlike the Angona system, it might actually peel off some planets and take those planets with them. You see how it's saying sometimes it draws off whole planets. The Angona system didn't steal any material from our sun. It pulled some out and formed into the solar system, but none of it got caught up in the gravitation of that dark island. You know, remember the Angona system's a dark island of space. You know, and got drug off with it as it headed off into deep space. But that isn't the way it always works. Sometimes planets are carried off. Sometimes even a quarter or a third of the sun gets ripped off and taken off by the system that's passing by. So there's a way to go on a diet for a star that once was big and it's not anymore. So there's a way that, another way that they could lose a lot of mass like we were just talking about earlier. Okay, so that's new, you see, in the context of talking about all these, about these stars. But then the basic stuff about how the sun, remember they mentioned, where was that back a few sections? when they said, your own son still carries a diminishing legacy of the mighty upwellings of its younger days, but the period has lengthened from the former 3 1/2 day pulsations to the present 11 1/2 year sunspot cycles. All right, so we had that 3 1/2 day pulsation thing happening, and the Angana system went by, and when it got that, you know, initially they said, how did they say that? Swung into near approach, and then they used that word that caught you off guard, and they said until nearest apposition, not opposition, but apposition. That just means, to be in apposition just means side by side. They're not, there's no directed at each other in opposition. They're just side by side. The difference between the two prefixes that are being added to the root there. So, you know, nearest apposition is just being nearest side by side. You know, so, you know, here's the sun, here's the Angana system, and they swing by each other, you know, and they, you know, kind of flip around each other gravitationally as they go by. You know, they're side by side, they're closer side by side, they're closest side by side, then they're not as close side by side. I mean, that's all you mean by apposition, is just when they're the nearest side by side. And you get this big tidal phenomenon where there's a tidal bulge, the primary tidal bulge on the Angana side and the secondary tidal bulge on the opposite side, you know, and you get all this matter pulled off of the of our sun. And the central portion of that big tongue of matter that was pulled off on the Angana side forms into these big gas giants, these cloud-bound types of worlds, as they describe them there, you know, almost big enough to especially Jupiter, you know, to be a star, you know, and so you almost pulled off enough matter to make another star, you know, next to it, next to the sun. But then the five on the outside of Jupiter and Saturn and the five on the inside of Jupiter and Saturn formed into smaller worlds. Okay, so that's how we got our solar system, and like I said, up in part three, you get the more lengthy description of all that. And they mentioned back, remember when we talked, you know, earlier on in an earlier paper, they talked about all these different ways that you can form solar systems and stuff. And, you know, remember how our method is you know, quite uncommon. All right, so they're just reminding you that. Let's read some more.
The majority of solar systems, however, had an origin entirely different from yours. And this is true even if those which were produced by gravity tidal technique. But no matter what technique of world building obtains, gravity always produces the solar system type of creation, that is, a central sun or dark island with planets, satellites, subsatellites, and meteors.
So, I mean, it's just invariably, no matter how the matter gets spewed out there or put in place, it's all going to eventually condense into some sort of a solar system-like thing that we understand. You know, if it's really complicated, you may have lots of subsatellites. You know, something we don't see a lot in ours. We've got planets and satellites, but it's not like a lot of the moons of planets have moons of their own. Okay, but you obviously could have a really complicated system where it literally gets to big objects that are in orbit about moons, let alone all the small stuff that's just floating around everywhere, the quote-unquote meteors. All right, so you go, okay, why are they telling me all this? Well, they're trying to just kind of remind you that when all is said and done, lots of different ways get you to a state where there may be an inhabitable planet orbiting a star. The universe was created to be inhabited. It's not a coincidence that even with all the random different things that are happening, you know, things going by, stars being ripped in half and whatnot, when all is said and done, things settle into stars and solar systems where there's inhabitable planets. That's the point. So they're kind of condensing all the confusion down to, there gets to be a solar system and life can be implanted. See, they're bringing it home, distilling the chaos into the order of an inhabitable world.
So that's an overriding purpose, irregardless of how it comes about.
Yeah, and see, and when all is said and done, there is no coincidence to this. You know, remember, as random as all these processes may be, of stars getting, you know, torn in two and stuff, it's all within supremacy. There are no coincidences in supremacy. You know, and this is all an intricate process, a creative act spread out over time. And all the seeming randomness, you know, when all is said and done, will be, you know, a precise dance of automatons that distill into that final state. And you go, well, and I look back on it, that's the only way it could have come to be like that. So it'll all, you know, it'll all come together into an amazing order. And that order, will be, because the only reason it exists, all this matter exists in the first place, is to be inhabited.
Basically, it's just a different way of doing the same thing they did in the center of the universe, right, but not by fiat.
Right.
So, but yeah, evolution is more of a different way to do fiat.
Right. It's, you know, creating the central universe is creativity. Creating the super universes is creativity in time. That's the only difference. Right. Yeah. Like I said, I mean, you know, the finger snap of the magic man creating the universe. Yeah, okay. Just, you know, slow down in your mind the finger snap, you know, and look, stretch out the details of that finger snap. That's called evolution, you know. Evolution all encompassed is just the finger snap of creation. It's just that it's slowed down, quote unquote, so you can see all the details. Whereas, you know, it wasn't slowed down so anyone could see the details in the central universe. It was just poof, right? But if you did slow it down, it would look like this. What happened in the central universe is happening here.
In time.
It's just all the details are spread out invisible, whereas they were, all those details were bottled up in there. You know, it was just, you know, it's even more than eventuated into existence. It was eternalized into existence. But but effectively, see, it's just take all the time and squish it down to nothing, and there's no difference between the two creative acts.
The beings in the central universe don't have a direct possession of that experience.
Right. But internalized within them and non-experienceable is a foundation. I mean, in the same way that, you know, once you are an absonite being and doing absonite things, it's not like all of your finite experiential nature disappears. It's all down inside of you. You know, all that evolution gets eventuated, gets encompassed and bottled up inside. There's the same effective thing inside of a Havona being. It's just that it was never on the outside and then got put on the inside. It's always been on the, you know, inside and not experienceable in the external world. It's a purely inner life fact.
That's why it's who you're becoming.
Yeah.
They have no consciousness of struggling through.
Right, yeah. But just appreciate there's a foundation inside of them, or they couldn't relate to you. In a way, see, when you relate to a Havona native, you will make what was invisible visible. Through you, what's inside of them and can't be seen will come out, you know, and they'll be able to kind of see themselves inside out through you. They will begin to experience their unexperienceable nature by experiencing you. Yeah. I mean, you know, the super additive consequence of a relationship between that which is perfecting and that which is perfect is that which is perfected. You know, that's how you become a perfected being, is that relationship to that which is perfect. You know, this super additive consequence of you kind of bringing the time out of them and them bringing the eternity out of you. Right. All right.
The physical aspects of the individual worlds are largely determined by mode of origin, astronomical situation, and physical environment. Age, size, rate of revolution, and velocity through space are also determining factors. Both the gas contraction and the solid accretion worlds are characterized by mountains, and during their earlier life, when not too small, by water and air. The molten split and collisional worlds are sometimes without extensive mountain ranges.
Okay, just some basic facts there, that water and an atmosphere are very common. The run-of-the-mill, non-terraformed atmosphere is a carbon dioxide atmosphere. And that's why Venus and Mars have carbon dioxide atmospheres, because they weren't terraformed. They've been terraformed, and they have an oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere. But, there is an atmosphere just naturally, in general, for every world, and water. Water is a super common molecule, so water is not that uncommon. You have lots and lots of worlds that have water and don't have any life on them.
So it's not qualifying it by saying during the earlier life? Such that water might not be around during the afterlife?
Yeah, I mean, like Mars doesn't have water on the surface anymore, for instance. And if it was ones that are even smaller, didn't have any at all to begin with. And they're just giving you that basic sense of...
running out of water in California.
Now, the one little thing I want to just throw in there, see that when they're talking about characterized by mountains, they're thinking more in terms of the mountain chains that result from plate tectonics. Okay, as opposed to just kind of highlands when it's in that pre-plate tectonics continental drift sort of mode, and it's just flexing, and there's highlands and lowlands and whatnot as this elastic thing is flexing. Talking about molten split and collisional worlds, when we finally could study the surface of Venus, we discovered it didn't have plate tectonics. Didn't have mountain ranges. It didn't have things like the Andes and the Rockies and whatnot. Or the Himalayas, where two plates are slamming together, or anything like that. The other thing that you know about Venus is that its rotation on its axis is not prograde, it's retrograde. Well, the only way it could have a retrograde rotation is if a foreign object hit it. Collisional worlds. I remember the Andromeda system didn't capture any of our stuff, but we captured three significant sized planets that were orbiting around that gigantic system. Some of the little ones way out in the outer reaches were close enough that the sun snatched them away. And one of those three hit Venus, combined with it. Venus was rotating in a nice prograde way, the only way it could do conservation of angular momentum. And then this thing hit it and, brought it almost to a dead stop. It's rotating very slowly, in a retrograde way. Not surprisingly, when you look at that collisional world, it totally messed up that any process that would have led to plate tectonics or something like that. And like they're saying here, and you don't have any mountain chains or anything. You have a couple of highlands. You just have a little bit of a kind of a flexing sort of a state where there's a couple areas that are a little higher than the norm, but no chains of mountains or anything because there's no plate tectonics. So there's an example just in our solar system of what they're talking about there. And you certainly didn't have any direct data of that back in the beginning of the 20th century when they told you that.
So what happened to the one that hit it?
Combined with it. That's why Venus is almost as big as the Earth. You know, you'd expect it to be somewhere between Mercury and Earth in size because it's in the tongue, you know, the tail of the, you know. And then instead it's almost as big as the Earth. Yeah, it's because it's two objects merged together.
If it's habitable?
No. unless
800 degrees.
Yeah, remember the surface melts lead, it rains sulfuric acid. Yeah.
some special biology to do that.
Well, see, if something is in a very molten state and gets split apart, you know, it's going to totally disrupt the normal processes that would lead to a stable plate tectonic situation eventually. That's what they're talking about. So you're totally goofing up kind of the normal blend of elements and the flows within the world by these cataclysmic events.
Sure looks nice in the nighttime sky.
Yes, it does. All right, so anyway, that's something we can actually relate to with that collisional world thing with Venus.
During the earlier ages of all these new worlds, earthquakes are frequent. And they are all characterized by great physical disturbances, especially is this true of the gas contraction spheres, the worlds born of the immense nebular rings, which are left behind in the wake of the earlier condensation and contraction of certain individual suns. Planets having a dual origin, like Urantia, pass through a less violent and stormy youthful career. Even so, your world experienced an early phase of mighty upheavals characterized by volcanoes, earthquakes, floods, and terrific storms.
Okay, so you know, the details are up there in part three, but let's just notice the point they're making here in this more generalized context. You know, the main thing they're describing there, if you just have gas contraction spheres, as they're calling them there, is a solar system forming the way they current science thinks our solar system formed, where you just had a bunch of gas condensing, and the center condensed into a star, and then the disk, you know, condensed into planets. That's the way they think the current solar system formed, you know, which is not the way it formed. But there's, you know, some solar systems do form that way. And if you have planets that just are totally start out as a ball of gas that contracts and cools and solidifies, you know, picture that. You know, you've got all this material just settling down, you know, and as it gets tighter and tighter, and you know, there's going to be all kinds of, you know, as it is collapsing and trying to find a stable state. That's what they're describing. Those sorts of spheres are going to have, you know, really violent, you know, breaks and stuff as it's crushing, you know, it's starting as a ball of gas and finally it's kind of little billiard balls glued together with all kinds of gaps between them, and then you're crushing them and the thing has huge earthquakes and collapsing. Okay, so that process. Whereas with ours, it started out, you know, a gas contraction sphere, but then there's all this material that accreted onto it. You know, pile drivers. So, you know, so you got these rocks slamming down and pile driving it, you know, just like you're trying to tamp down something for a post, you know, or something like that, you know, taking all the air out of it. And right. See, so, you know, it got pounded. There's not a lot of air gaps, quote unquote. See, you know, so it was pretty tight. So by the time it got up to Earth, you know, its current size, you know, yeah, there's still going to be some shuffling around, but not the huge shuffling around that you'll get in some of these that are start out as this very fragile little collection of snowflakes that you then crush together into a solid object, right? Okay. So,
Chris, can you remind us what they mean by dual origin?
Yeah, that's what it's just describing. Dual is both gas contraction and then the accretion. Like that's described up there in part three. All right. Anything else? No, I think that's it. Okay, so that's now the final one here. And you notice there's a big gap here, so this is kind of a little footnote. Okay.
Urantia is comparatively isolated on the outskirts of Satania, your solar system, with one exception being the farthest removed from Gerasim, while Satania itself is next to the outermost system of Nerlaeshadec. And this constellation is now traversing the outer fringe of Nebadon. You were truly among the least of all creation until Michael's bestowal elevated your planet to a position of honor and great universe interest. Sometimes the last is first, while truly the least becomes greatest. Presented by an archangel in collaboration with the chief of Nebadon Power Centers.
So let's start with last and put it first. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Not just an archangel, but the chief of Nebadon Power Centers. Remember all those 100 power centers that are on Salvington?
That's pretty cool.
The chief is in collaboration on this paper. That's cool stuff. It reminds you they're very personal, remember? And power centers are persons, distinct persons, not like some of the master physical controllers. Okay, so that's pretty neat. You notice how they said, while truly, notice how they brought in the truth that I mentioned, you know, in the midst of all this discussion of facts. You know, so that you can think, you know, maybe not literally, factually, you know, the least becomes greatest, but truly the least becomes greatest. So in truth, getting you to think along those lines about the truth of all this, how no matter how, you know, remote and complicated things might be, it does all come down to persons and synchronizes with persons. Power and personality synthesize under the influence of the Supreme. So there's a great truth there. See, as they're bringing you to a close with. Now, the remaining little issue is a factual issue that we need to spend a couple minutes on here, even though it's a little bit over time. Because we've pondered about this issue off and on. Urantia is comparatively isolated on the outskirts of Satania, your solar system, with one exception, being the farthest removed from Gerasim. Okay? You know, we've tried to guess how far away from Gerasim we are, right? You know, and we see those couple spots in other parts of the book that seem to be suggesting that maybe it's a 5-year trip at 3 times the speed of light, so that it'd be 15 light years away. You're going, okay, you know, but then you see this one, this statement, and you're going, well, okay, there's only one solar system, you know, inhabited system that's is farther away from Gerasim. Don't we need to be more than 15 light years away for this to make sense then? That seems like maybe too small a number. Because, you know, when you do estimates of kind of the normal stellar density, and there's 2,000 stars, and, you know, you get ideas of maybe it's, say, I think when I've done that estimate, I think I've got it right here, I think it's like 48, you know, when you play around with that back of the envelope calculation, yeah, you get, if you imagine Satania to be spherical, you know, with a uniform distribution of stars, you get a sphere with a 48 light year radius, you know, which is a lot bigger than 15, you know. You know, talking like 3 times bigger. Okay, well, now notice, you know, that they said there's just, you know, it's interesting, they tell you there's just one that's farther out. Well, what else do we know about our planet? Are we planet number 5 in the system of Satania? No, we're 606, and there's only 619 right now. Okay. So, you're thinking about, okay, and they tell you they number them sequentially. So you're going, well, do they just randomly put these things around in a certain space? You know, is it possible that it's just totally not valid that it's 15 light years and I just need to throw that out? Or is that, you know, that seems like, is there any way that maybe this works together? Well, what if, you know, they really start in close and they're kind of just building out? And, you know, we've got a lot of solar systems to go yet. Remember, I got it written on that page too. I mean, what was it, 562, isn't it? Yeah. You know, to get to 619, yeah, 562. Maybe it's the case that we are just 15 light years away, and there's a lot of unused space outside of us yet. It's like, well, that seems like a lot of unused space. Yeah, well, they also tell you that things are still pretty rough out here. There might be regions of Satania that just are not usable yet. They also tell you that, unlike a lot of local systems, we have a very, very huge Dark Island space center of our system. Well, that could have an influence. I mean, that might produce a lot tighter density than in, you know, some systems might be more diffuse. You know, if everything is kind of more tightly tied in gravitational relationship to that gigantic Dark Island, maybe things are, you know, maybe you can have 619 and it still is not that far spread out. I mean, I'm throwing out all these different things because you got to remember there's a whole bunch of things you don't know here. There's a lot of different ways that this could all come together. You know, this doesn't necessarily make it impossible that we're 15 light years away. So you kind of just have to just be present with it, you know, and see if maybe some other things in the book might suggest other, maybe we need to explore our local region a little bit more and see if we can sort out some of these details ourselves. Is there some signs that the stellar density is kind of a little bit tighter in a certain direction in space, not too far from us? If so, that might be the direction towards Gerasim. That might be an interesting thing. See, those sorts of things I think just need to play out. Okay.
Well, a larger mass at the center of the system, couldn't that actually allow for a larger area? Because it would be able to hold things that were farther away than...
Well, again, see, there's all these questions. I mean, yeah, you need to hold the local universe together, but how much do you need to, hold the local systems together? You know, especially over long spans of time. When a local universe is settled in light and life, the structure of things may change. Remember, it kind of ceases to be really a local universe constellation, local system. It starts to just be constellations in the super universe, you know, in those advanced stages of settled. So, yeah, see, there's all these issues that are, you know, we don't know. I'm just trying to suggest, you know, to kind of be open to a lot of different ways that you might rationalize this before you start ruling out any possibilities. But you can notice that there seems to be on the initial surface some tension between this statement and those other deductions that maybe it's 15 light years. So you have to kind of just, you know, That's why you've never heard me say it's absolutely 15 light years away. It's like, well, you know, there's this one thing that kind of seems to suggest that. I try to always qualify when I say that. But it may not be. Maybe this needs to be rethought. Maybe some of the systems, maybe when some planets get really highly settled, they start to, maybe those Melchizedeks didn't have to come from Gerasim. Maybe they came from kind of a satellite location on a world that's been settled in the seventh stage of light and life for billions and billions of years. You know, and it's 15 light years away from us instead of Gerasim. I mean, so there's a number of possibilities. Okay? I mean, I think you can, it's got to be at least 15 light years, I think, to Gerasim. It might be further, but it seems like the data session, it must be at least that. It must be at least a 5-year journey. Maybe it's more. But, yeah. So that's kind of how you have to play this when they give you data points like this. Stay open to options, but don't be afraid to start taking hold of something if it seems to have some tangibility to it, you know, and try to use it as a working hypothesis and see if you can refute it, you know, maybe this refutes that, maybe not, you know, you got to reflect on it, you know, over some time. All right. Okay. So we'll get into paper 42, next time, you know. Stay strong here. We got a whole nother paper of some heavy duty physics to go yet. Before we kind of leak out into the clear, got a lot of universes of things to study yet. But it's fun stuff if you kind of open your mind to it. So let's take a moment here.